Hello, Olympics and Paralympics fans, and welcome to Keep the Flame Alive's Games History Moment, where we look at the past editions of the Games. All year long, we will be looking at Chamonix 1924, which is billed as the first Winter Olympic Games and is celebrating its 100th anniversary in 2024. I am your host, Jill Jarris, joined as always by my lovely co-host, Allison Brown. Allison, hello, how are you?
Hello, it's a little chilly in our story today, but I think we'll be okay.
Oh, ice and snow. Here we go. What do you got?
March is Women's History Month, so we're going to talk about the women that were in Chamonix.
Okay. How many?
There were 13 out of 300 athletes, because women were allowed to compete in exactly one sport and in two events, ladies and pairs figure skating.
Not a surprise given this point in history.
Yes, and several of the women competed in both events. So you've got some overlap of how many women there were.
I would love to know what either a pairs or a singles figure skater today would say to having to compete in both events.
Well, if you remember, Christy Yamaguchi skated in pairs she was a pairs national champion.
Right, but not at the same time.
At the same time.
Oh, was she really?
Yes, she was competing in women's and pairs at the same time. She's probably the last kind of big star that did that. So it's a long tradition to do both, but we really don't see it much anymore.
Interesting.
We are going to talk about the men as well.
Okay.
Because their story is pretty interesting. So let's start with talking about what the skates of the 1920s look like. They look very much like the skates of today. The boots came up a little higher on the calf, and they were soft and very flexible. So they didn't have that stiffness in the leather. So that made them less stable. In 1914 was the first time the blades were made from a single piece of steel. And this allowed the blade to be tapered to a pointed edge, otherwise known as a toe pick. So the toe pick in the 1920s didn't have the saw teeth that we see today. It was a single point. So we're going to post some links to videos from 1924. And you'll see a lot of the skaters pirouette on that tip, like a top. So the style was very different. And because of those soft, flexible boots, you'll see a lot of bent arms and legs, because balancing on that boot was a lot more difficult.
Interesting.
Won't see a lot of Sasha Cohen style extension in these routines from 1924. So at the time, the individual figure skating events included two parts, compulsory figures and a free skating program. The compulsory figures counted for 60% of the final score, and results were based on the placement system. Remember ordinals?
Oh, wow.
So it didn't matter what your raw score was. It mattered what your score was in relation to the other skaters. It was out of 10 points, not the 6.0. We don't see 6.0s yet. So if you got a 10 and someone else got a 9, it didn't matter. It was that you were ahead of the other, you got more points than the other person. And if someone got a 10 and the next ranking person got a 6, they would still be 1 and 2. So the competition in Chamonix was held outdoors in the Olympic Stadium. Because of the fluctuating temperature, the ice surface was very uneven. There were puddles, it was wet. There were points in the competition. All the competitions took place over 3 days. The 29th, 30th, and 31st of January, red flags had to be placed on the ice so the skaters didn't lose track of where they were.
Oh, that's really interesting. Because today you have different points around the venue, I would imagine, that they look for and spot to.
Right. This was just a giant sheet of ice. This is the same ice that they're using for long track, for hockey. It's just sort of divided off or being competed at different times. And there's no Zamboni. So
right.
We are definitely not seeing a smooth, perfect ice surface.
Wow. Which makes me wonder when all of that comes into play further down in history, where you have your development of figure skating ice versus hockey ice versus speed skating ice.
So let's start with the men. And Swede Gillis Grafström won the Olympic title in Antwerp, where figure skating was part of the Summer Olympics, and he was the best skater of his era. Originally, he trained with Ulrich Salchow, the inventor of the Salchow, and Grafström excelled at compulsory figures, but he was also kind of the inventor of artistry. He had a lot of elegance. He had a lot of musicality in his performance. He invented the flying sit spin and was the first competitor to master the axel jump. His greatest rival was Willy Bockel of Austria, and he skated with a lot more power, and he was the first to land a double loop, though at the time it was called, I believe, a Rittenberger. And to no one's surprise, Olympic judging controversies started early in this sport. The two Austrian judges put Bockel first throughout the competition, and he also won the free skating portion of the program because not everybody liked Grafström's style because he wasn't as traditional as Bockel. But Grafström's scores from the compulsory round were so strong that he ended up winning his second of three Olympic gold medals.
Wow. And so that's Summer Olympics and Winter Olympics, same sport. And then the next Winter Olympics?
Correct. He won in 1928 as well. Bockel won silver and Georg Gockschi of Switzerland earned the bronze. So the women's competition is most often remembered for the debut of a little 11-year-old Norwegian girl named Sonja Henie. She finished last among the eight competitors. Don't feel too bad for her. Henie, who was then coached by Gillis Grafström, went on to win the next three Olympic competitions and probably was the most famous and influential skater of the pre-World War II era. So Sonja Henie is certainly known for her musicality and bringing those dance elements. And a lot of that came from her collaboration with Grafström. So they really revolutionized the sport of figure skating. The favorite in the ladies' competition was the figure skating queen of the 1920s, Herna Blank Szabo from Austria. Szabo was the first skater to perform in a short skirt as opposed to the ankle-length dresses that were popular at the time. She was ranked first by all the judges and easily won the gold medal. American Beatrice Lofgren won silver. She went on to win a bronze in 1928 and another silver in 1932. All of these skaters had incredibly long careers, well into their 30s.
But they also weren't pounding as much with as many complicated jumps as you see today.
Yes. And Beatrix Lofgren's silver in 1932 was in pairs with partner Sherwin Badger. Britt Ethel Mulcult excelled at figures but finished sixth in the free skate, but she managed to hang on for bronze. We're going to hear her name again. So many skaters, as I mentioned earlier, competed in both singles and pairs, like Ethel Mulcult and Jack Page, who did both, and Canadian Cecil Smith and Melville Rogers, who both did both. Four of the pairs were married, and another pair ended up getting married later. Gold in the pairs went to Helene Engelmann and Alfred Berger of Austria. So funny, Austrians were such a powerhouse in figure skating in the early days. And when was the last time we heard from an Austrian figure skater?
I know. It's amazing.
Silver went to Ludovica and Walter Jakobsen from Finland. And the French pair, André Joly and Pierre Brunet, that's our couple who got married later, ended up with the bronze. Scoring controversy alert. The Jakobsen's ordinals ranged from first to fourth. Joly and Brunet's from second to sixth. Even fourth place finishers Mulcult and Page had a first place ordinal.
Wow.
And guess who gave them that?
The British judge?
The British judge. So there were scoring changes made after these games where you could not have more than one judge from a single country.
Oh, because then they could stack the deck if they wanted to do
Correct.
That judging-wise.
Guess who had a lot of judges? Austria. So Joly and Brunet went on to win gold in 28 and 32. They later emigrated to the United States and became coaches of a couple names you may have heard of, Carol Heiss and Scott Hamilton.
Very nice. The legacy lives on.
Yeah, a lot of these skaters, you see the names continue on through the history. So these early skaters really shaped the sport in a way that we can't even understand at this point. Because as I'm reading all these biographies, this one invented or founded Skating Magazine. This one moved to this country and brought skating to this country and coaching and judging. So these early skaters really created the sport that is probably the most beloved in the Winter Olympics today.
Fascinating. Let's give a shout out to our sources.
Ah, yes, of course. So I've got Ole Mad Men, Olympedia, Olympics.com, the CBC, Skate Guard blog, Science Friday, and the Olympics.com has some videos that we will share, both a little of Sabo and a little bit of Henny and Grofstrom.
Fantastic. It's always interesting to see like the first entry of somebody who goes on to be a major superstar. But 11 years old?
Which means she was only 15 the first time she won the gold medal. And she's absolutely beautiful in the video. You see her beautiful, bright, smiling face. So you can tell this girl's going to be a star without knowing the whole story. But wow, what magnetism, even in this very grainy, very poor quality old footage of her. And Grofstrom as well. You get a little view of him. And what a beautiful skater.
Interesting. I do wonder, like, if we were around in 1924, would we be discussing age limits for the sport? I mean, because there were several Olympics with very young competitors. And here we have another example with Sonja Henie being 11 years old and an Olympian.
Difference is, you know, there's no social media in 1924 or paparazzi. Well, there was, but certainly not. I don't think anybody was hiding out in Sonja Henie's bathroom trying to catch her doing stuff.
Well, thank you so much. Fascinating as always. And we will have you back next month for another look at Chamonix 1924.